Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 10th of July, these are our main stories. Russia's foreign minister warns the chances of nuclear confrontation with the US are rising. The Philippines' top broadcaster has been taken off the air by the government. And
we never benefited from that sacrifice because we went back to a pre-pandemic world. And you see it in the data. And you see it in the lives lost.
Why coming out of lockdown too quickly has had deadly consequences for the US state of Arizona. Also in this podcast, one of India's most notorious gangsters has been killed a day after being arrested over a deadly attack on the police. And
I think that you will find that those who have had the fortune to visit or to live all believe that we have a near idyllic climate.
An invitation to enjoy the beauty of Barbados. First, the last remaining nuclear treaty between the US and Russia expires next year, but there are doubts that it'll be extended, and that means a higher risk of nuclear war, according to a statement by the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov shortly before we recorded this podcast. Our correspondent in Moscow, Steve Rosenberg, told me exactly what Mr. Lavrov has been saying.
While he was talking about international strategic stability deteriorating, he blamed America for that fair and square. He said America wants to regain global dominance and secure a victory in the rivalry of the great powers. So some dramatic words. But basically, what Mr. Lavrov was saying today, Russian officials have been saying for some time now. Russia has made it clear on many occasions that it believes that global strategic stability is deteriorating and nuclear risks are increasing and that America is to blame. And the Russians say, well, look at what America's been doing in the last 20 years. If you go back to 2001, President Bush pulled out of a key treaty, the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Last year, Donald Trump pulled out of the INF treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Treaty, one of the cornerstones of East-West arms control back in the 80s. And questions remain about the fate of the last remaining nuclear treaty, the only one left, New START, it's called, which limits the numbers of long-range nuclear warheads. And as you mentioned, that treaty expires next year, next February. The clock is ticking, and it's not clear whether it will be extended.
So this is not exactly a new position by Russia. So why is Mr. Lavrov upping the ante by saying it so loudly today?
Well, I think partly because the clock is ticking, because so little time is left. Now, already talks have begun between America and Russia on extending this. They haven't borne fruition yet. There may be more talks next month on that. The problem is, Russia is keen to extend this last remaining nuclear treaty. The Americans less so. The Trump administration has said it would like China involved in three-way talks. But there's no sign of that happening. In fact, the head of the Chinese Foreign Ministry's Department of Arms Control said today that China is ready to join disarmament talks, but only if America reduces its arsenal to match China's own level. And there's no sign of that happening.
Our correspondent Steve Rosenberg with me from Moscow. ABS-CBN is the largest media and entertainment group in the Philippines, reaching more than 15 million homes. 2 months ago, the government accused it of tax evasion and bias against President Rodrigo Duterte and told it to stop broadcasting. Now, politicians have voted not to renew its 25-year-old license. Our correspondent in Manila, Howard Johnson, spoke to me from the ABS-CBN newsroom.
At the moment, I'm going to have to speak sotto voce here because the owner of the company is giving a prayer at the moment. All the journalists are gathered around as he reads this prayer. Obviously, the feeling here is very sad, a feeling of remorse that the company is now suffering from a shutdown, effectively. Earlier on, I spoke to the head of news, Regina Reyes, and she told me about the mood after she found out that ABS-CBN would effectively not get a 25-year franchise renewal.
I am both very sad and very angry, very stunned by it all. But I know I have to be strong for my team. It's very difficult to be impartial, be objective as to how we are covering this story right now. But we are journalists and we are sworn to be reporting any issue as fairly and as accurately as possible. And so that is what we are trying to do today.
So, Howard, this comes in the context of a big conversation about press freedom in the Philippines, one that's very live and happening with the journalists around you there in Manila right now. It's only a couple of months ago that the founder of Rappler was charged with cyber libel and sentenced to 6 years in prison. Tell me more about the conversation in the country about press freedom.
Well, in many ways, people see this country as a petri dish for what could happen if you have a populist leader who changes the landscape as far as media. He is a big advocate of social media. We've seen lots of his supporters online. They will gather around and they will cajole journalists saying that they're fake news, that they have a biased reporting. And that's what happened with ABS-CBN. They were told that they were reporting in a biased fashion against the president. In 2016, they failed to run one of his presidential election campaign adverts, and that really piqued Rodrigo Duterte's anger. He said in 2017 that he would block the franchise, which is what we have seen effectively today. But the ABS-CBN CEO said that he acknowledged that he hadn't run that advert, but also said they hadn't run other politicians' adverts around that time as well. But yes, we're seeing other attacks on other journalists here online, or also with Rappler, the case where 11 cases were filed against them in 1 year, which critics say is obviously an orchestrated campaign to bring them down. The supporters of the president say that this is just a changing landscape where the old media is on its way out and social media is on the rise.
Howard Johnson with me from the ABS-CBN newsroom in Manila. The coronavirus pandemic is gaining worrying momentum in Africa, according to John Nketengasong, the director of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention. It's reporting that cases have risen by almost a quarter in the past week, a worrying statistic, as Mr. Nketengasong explained to my colleague Alan Kasuja.
As of today, the continent has registered over 520,000 cases. And if we compare that with last week, it represents a 25% increase, which in actual number translates to over 100,000 new cases.
What do you think is the reason for that? Is it a case of more testing, or the pandemic is spreading like wildfire?
It's a combination of both. I mean, our testing has increased significantly as a continent. We've now conducted over 5.7 million tests. The second reason is that the virus is seeding into the population, gaining hold into vulnerable populations. And we know that countries are beginning to ease their restrictions, and that will obviously lead to an increase in number of cases. What we ought to do is to really take more aggressive public health measures, including making sure that masks become universal across the continent. That should be coupled with the ability to expand our testing. We established a platform called the African Medical Supply Platform with variable diagnostics. Through the platform, you can actually go in and buy whatever quantities that you need for your country.
I have just looked at a newspaper headline in Kenya. Millions of Kenyans cannot buy food or pay rent, according to a survey. Oxfam said yesterday more people might die from hunger than the pandemic. You have to wonder how much longer people can take the lockdown and the economic pressure that has come with the pandemic.
It is not a question of whether we save lives versus saving economies. It's now the choice in front of us is how to save lives and save economies. And that is why I keep insisting that the way that you unlock your economy safely and save livelihoods is to expand our testing, is to engage the community more so that the community understand actually that testing is part of unlocking your economy, is part of reviving your economy.
Are you expecting things to get worse in Africa before they get better?
First phase of this fight was fought extremely well because of a strong, coordinated and leadership approach that the continent employed. Now we are the second phase of this pandemic, not the second wave, but the second phase, which means we are unlocking our economies and we have to be aggressive. If we implement the aggressive public health measures, then we have a chance of fighting back. But if not, then we can expect a worst case scenario to happen.
John Nketengasong, director of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, with Alan Kasuja. The US state of Arizona has emerged as a coronavirus hotspot. Its hospital beds are reaching capacity. Instead of gradually reopening after lockdown, the state opened up fast, including nightclubs. And now, as in much of the US, it's young people who are contracting the virus. Sophie Long has more.
I didn't really care much about COVID. I mean, it was a joke to us.
When the governor of Arizona lifted the state's stay-at-home order, people partied, pre-pandemic style. Young people poured into bars and filled nightclubs to capacity. Days later, many woke up to what will probably be the worst hangover of their lives. Jimmy Flores was among them.
I was in a hospital for 8 days. I was on an oxygen tube for 8 days. And I lost like 25 pounds, a lot of it muscle mass, you know, and just like I kept getting stabs to the stomach of anti-blood clotting medicine, you know, and I was getting antibiotics ran through my body daily, and it would hurt. It was burning like my veins, you know, because of how strong the medicine was.
Outside, amid the steamy heat and cicadas, the former director of public health, Will Humble, told me it's clear what's gone so badly wrong here.
We sacrificed a lot during the stay-at-home order, but because of policy decisions that were made at the end of that stay-at-home order, we never benefited from that sacrifice because we went back to a pre-pandemic world. And you see it in the data. And you see it in the lives lost.
The bars and nightclubs have now been shut down again. The pumping music has been replaced by an eerie quiet in the area of Phoenix known as Little Vegas. The young and carefree can still gather at restaurant bars as long as they're buying food. But the conversation is more subdued. They all know people their own age who've got it or have had it. Many know someone who didn't survive. But it's still the older, more vulnerable people they're helping to infect that are most likely to die from it.
I know, I wish I could hug everybody, I know.
Kristen Urquiza held a small vigil for her father, Mark, who she lost to COVID last week.
The hardest part was not being able to be in the room with him when he died. I've been speaking to the nurse who was with him over Facebook. She found me, and she's wonderful. And it's been wonderful to connect with her. But being robbed of that, to be able to actually hold his hand, I'll never get that back.
Her pain is still raw, and her rage is directed at the governor of Arizona and at the president.
I think the Trump administration has done the most terrible job possible on managing this crisis. The president is not actually saying much about this other than downplaying it, and as a result, it's sending mixed messages.
But while arguments continue about who should or shouldn't have done what, when, it's the state's medical staff whose tired hearts break as they contemplate being forced to make decisions they never thought they would have to. Dr. Murtaza Akhtar took a short break from the ER to speak to me.
Sometimes you just have to go into crisis mode, and what that means is basically having to triage, like in the military setting, who gets to get that resource and who doesn't. Right now, if somebody is sick and needs a resource, we give it to that person. But if you have very limited resources and you know a bunch of sick patients need it, you have to pick and choose who gets that life-saving intervention. That's a horrible situation to be in. I've never had to be in that situation. Maybe a miracle will happen. It kind of did in New York, where they just managed to escape. But we're not in New York. We don't have the same resources. So I'm concerned about what's going to happen in a week and a couple weeks from now. That's the scariest part for me.
Dr. Murtaza Akhtar ending that report from Arizona by our correspondent Sophie Long. Conservationists are planning to introduce wild bison to British woodland for the first time in thousands of years in a project that aims to recreate an ancient habitat. Here's Abigail Maudsley.
Two wildlife trusts in southeast England are preparing to settle a small herd of endangered European bison, the continent's biggest land mammal, in a woodland reserve by the spring of 2022. They say the beasts will help to manage their habitat naturally, felling trees by rubbing against them and creating dust baths in a former pine plantation. This will create clearings and dead wood, allowing more diverse species of plants, animals, fungi and insects to flourish.
Abigail Maudsley reporting. Still to come in this podcast, while the historic city of Venice, which is in the middle of a lagoon, has tested a new system of flood defences, even though it hasn't finished building them yet. First, police in India have shot dead a high-profile gangster a day after he was arrested. Vikas Dubé, who'd been on the run for a week, was accused of killing eight policemen in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. Our correspondent in Delhi, Divya Arya, has been telling me more.
Vikas Dubé was a dreaded gangster. He had 60 cases against him, including of murders, an attempt to murders, one of a BJP leader famously shot inside a police station by him. Despite all of that, he had been living freely in his house in his village. He had a huge bungalow, lots of expensive cars. The police went to arrest him a week back and were fired upon, allegedly, by him and his men. 8 policemen died, and that is why the case has been dominating news headlines since. Vikas had been absconding in the week since that attack on the policeman. 4 of his aides were killed in encounters by the police that the police declared. And then Vikas was very dramatically captured in a different state, a little further from the state he hails from, yesterday morning, only to be again killed in an encounter today.
This drama unfolded in a temple, didn't it? He was handed over to the police by the authorities in the temple.
Well, that is what the police have stated. They have said that he had come there just as a normal person. He did not hide himself. He just went to pray, and that's when he was spotted and handed over to the police. In fact, the minister in the state government said justice has been served because he was lawfully taken away by the police and handed over to the North Indian state Uttar Pradesh's police. But questions have been raised in the manner in which he was found at the temple, many saying it was actually a surrender that was just crafted for public. And in fact, there must have been an understanding that he will not be killed the way his aides have been killed by the police. Instead, he will surrender in a different state, and therefore that will guarantee him some protection. In fact, a petition was filed in the Supreme Court after his arrest yesterday, asking that his safety be ensured and he get a chance at a fair trial. But even before that petition could be heard, he was killed. As the police allege, he tried to flee their custody today morning.
Divya Arya with me from Delhi. Almost exactly 10 years ago, suicide bombings were carried out in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The targets were football fans who were watching TV coverage of the World Cup at various locations around the city. The Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attacks, which killed 74 people. In 2016, 7 of the accused, including the mastermind of the attacks, were found guilty of terrorism. But what of those who survived? Hassan Ndugwa started a programme to work with Muslim youth vulnerable to being recruited by extremist groups. He told Patience Atuhair how he'd reacted to the attack.
I stood up and started running for my life. As I started running, amid these loud screams and wailing, I ran faster and faster. A fragment had hit me, and it had also broke some of my teeth. Some of my friends had to go through multiple surgeries.
And how did the experience affect you psychologically?
I had to visit a psychiatrist for several months. I used to fear crowds. I watch a lot of basketball, I watch a lot of rugby. So when that happened, I could not go back to those big gatherings for quite some time.
You went on then to start a program to work with young people, young Muslim men especially.
It's from this experience that I managed to draw a new path. I watched the news, and what was shocking is that Muslims had killed people. But also, what really disturbed me so much was the fact that Muslim youth were paraded as suspects and accomplices to this attack. So for me and my colleague, Ahmed Haji, with whom we survived, we felt like there was a hijack on the religion that we believed in, because we believed Islam is a religion of peace that preaches non-violence and tolerance. We've been working to help young people such that they don't become vulnerable to extremist recruitment. We provide them with alternatives in vocational skills, in photography, for example, and videography, hairdressing, fashion and design, electrical wiring, to such that they are known, they're busy somewhere, they have a future, they have something that they wake up to every day.
In 2016, the masterminds of these bombings, alongside several other people, were tried and sentenced to life in prison. Do you think this was enough?
I think more needs to be done, because the problem is still alive in the country and in the region. Unless the authorities or government comes in to address the underlying causes of violent extremism, to understand why people continue to be attracted to extremist activities, addressing issues of unemployment, issues of marginalization, issues of human rights violations, issues related to inequalities and other social, economic, political injustices. Because those are the drivers, those are the factors that drive individuals into extremist groups.
Hassan Ndugwa with Patience Atuhair. The Italian lagoon city of Venice has tested its giant mobile flood barriers today. The system was supposed to come into operation a decade ago, and even now it isn't finished. The Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte watched from a Coast Guard ship.
This is a massive project that's been waiting for years to be completed, a barrier that extends for 1.6 kilometres. It's a project that was born from many controversies and designed to protect Venice from high water. A concrete objective, not an imaginary one, however visionary it might have seemed when it was designed.
Emily Haller told me more about the importance of today's trial.
It was the first time that they've tested the barrier system in full. It's been tested in part before, but this is the first time that all of the barrier blockades have been used together. So you could see that there was these big yellow blocks that rose out of the water to connect into a big chain blockading the Venice lagoon from the Adriatic Sea, and it sort of forms a sea wall, basically.
And for anyone who hasn't seen the video or the pictures of this, it's a huge thing, isn't it?
Yeah, they're massive, massive, bright yellow blocks, oblong in shape, that connect together, and they're normally sat on the ocean floor. They rise them up to basically, yeah, form a wall.
And the Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, and others were watching the testing procedure from boats.
Yeah, so he said that he hopes that it will be completed by next autumn, winter, because there's still about 18 months of work to be done. It's been an over 15-year process to get this project near completion, sort of marred with controversy and allegations of corruption. In fact, several officials have actually been arrested because of these allegations of corruption and bribery.
And just to explain, Emily, what is the threat to Venice? Why is Venice seeing more and more flooding happening?
Every year, Venice floods, and late last year, it suffered its worst floods in over half a century with billions of dollars of damage. They call it Acqua Alta, which is high waters, and it's just a very real risk for the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Venice.
Emily Haller reporting. Now, this sounds like a pretty good deal, working from home but doing it on a tropical island. The offer could be on the table from the Caribbean island of Barbados. It's trying to make up for the effect the coronavirus outbreak has had on its economy. Jonathan Savage is tempted.
In Plenty and in Time of Need is the title of the national anthem of Barbados, and this is A Time of Need.
Plane travel effectively stalled across the Atlantic and across the Americas from the end of March, early April. We recognise that it's not going to come back in a hurry with the volume that it was there before, but that we needed to think outside of the box.
That's the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Amor-Motley, as her government considers a plan to allow foreigners a special visa of up to 12 months to live on Barbados while working for their current employer back home. More than 40% of Barbadian GDP comes directly or indirectly from tourism, and almost one in three workers depend on the industry for their livelihoods. There's a big hole to be filled in the Barbadian economy. So what is Barbados like? Why should we want to base ourselves there? Here's Prime Minister Motley again.
Because you know it's paradise. I think that you will find that those who have had the fortune to visit or to live all believe that we have a near idyllic climate. We have one of the highest qualities of life for a developing country, any part of the world. If you look at the Global Competitiveness Index, it is in the areas of education and health that Barbados is most globally competitive.
If you're tempted, there are some things to bear in mind. For example, homosexuality is illegal in Barbados, although the law is rarely enforced. And as the plan hasn't been finalised, we don't know for sure if, for example, you'll be covered by the country's universal healthcare or other public services. You'll also need to be free of COVID-19 when you arrive, of course. But if you're willing to take the plunge, the warm waters of Barbados are getting ready to bid you welcome.
Jonathan Savage reporting. Now, it's time for news from elsewhere, our weekly look at some of the less reported stories from around the world. Let's go to Istanbul and talk to Dilay Yalcin from BBC Monitoring, which tracks news media in many languages. And first, Dilay, an Instagram post by a well-known Turkish actress mocking her own pregnancy kilos became a big talking point this week.
Yes, well, Bergzai Korel, who has starred in internationally acclaimed TV dramas such as 1001 Nights, wrote the post to mock how women's weight is discussed in the Turkish media. You often read about famous women's appearances and their weight, illustrated, of course, by photos of them in swimsuits or bikinis, and some of these reporting can be quite derogatory for women. So what Korel did was she posted a series of photos of herself in a bikini that showed the weight she gained after giving birth recently. And she wrote the caption in that very typical tabloid style. Bergzai Korel was caught in a bikini. That's one of her descriptions. And another one was also mimicking the style of tabloid reporting, saying the weight that Bergzai Korel gained and her cellulite after the birth has caused astonishment. So she was basically mocking the tabloid's treatment of women.
And she got lots of support from other women.
Yes, absolutely. The post received over 800,000 likes, and many women, including fellow actresses, posted comments of support and praise for showing high self-esteem. Many mothers also shared their stories of being body-shamed after birth, thanking Korel for her courage. Another person said that with her preemptive post, she, in effect, prevented the press from commenting on her post-pregnancy appearance.
Satire, a good way of making your point. This is another example now of the power of humour, this one from Germany, where Berlin's public transport management came up with a way of persuading commuters to wear face masks.
Yes, exactly. Berlin's transport operator did something far more eye-catching than simply scorn passengers into following the rules. Wearing face masks is compulsory on public transport in Berlin because of the COVID-19 outbreak, but many people have apparently been wearing them under their noses in a way that actually defies the whole point of wearing a mask. So Berlin's transport operator called on commuters to stop wearing deodorants. So you really will want to cover your nose. It was an attempt, they said, to harness the power of body odor, which can be particularly potent on a packed underground train in the summertime. The company posted a bright yellow ad on social media declaring that because of non-compliance with the rules, they were getting tough. And the operator is actually well known for its humorous campaigns. It made headlines last year when it lodged a tongue-in-cheek application with UNESCO, arguing that Berlin's transport network should actually be added to the World Heritage List.
Dilay, thank you. Dilay Yalcin from BBC Monitoring with us from Istanbul with this week's news from elsewhere. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or any of the stories we included, do drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.